give that shit up, you're going to concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Welcome to this week's edition of a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Bossy and Paul. This is the coaching podcast with a difference. We watch a movie, it might help if you watch it too, we get a special guest on, and we discuss the coaching from the movie and how it relates to our own experiences. So whether you're in the car, out for a run or a walk, or just using us to cancel out the noise from the kids in the background, we hope you enjoy.
Okay, so welcome everybody. So I'm delighted to say we got Bossy and Paul as always.
How you doing, man? You all okay?
Good, and I'm delighted to say we got Mr. David Gillick with us this week. So thanks very much, David.
No problem, lads. Delighted to chat to you.
Good. So look, I suppose everyone would be familiar with your running career, but I suppose you're a bit tutoring, mentoring a few others now at this stage.
Yeah, doing a little bit. I suppose post career involved in a couple of kind of the committees, like the Olympic Federation, the Athletes Commission, and kind of getting back into. I say getting back into it because I probably kind of stepped away from a little bit, but you know, doing my levels now in terms of my coach education and then helping out on the mentoring side as well with a couple of other coaches around the country. And like, I'm not coaching anyone directly myself, but it is something that I will like to get into over the next kind of couple of years. But it's always nice to kind of just give something back, and we have a lot of talent kind of in the sprint events coming through now as well, which is great to see. So, you know, trying to kind of maybe just help people with experiences and a bit of knowledge and stuff like that is always kind of just to kind of help the next generation more so, yeah.
And would you find now, let's say, from your involvement now, let's say, with committees and stuff, has there been much of an advancement or improvement in, I suppose, what's there first for the up-and-coming athletes and stuff like that?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I think that the whole kind of landscape has changed. I think the mindset has changed. I think they're very much keeping the athlete at the center of decision making, which is really, really positive. You know, the bricks and mortar have like vastly improved. You know, when I was coming through, like I relocated to the UK in 2006. There was nothing in Ireland at the time in terms of a high performance setup. Now you have Abbottstown. Now you have, you know, it's fair to say there's kind of a couple of satellite institutes around, you know, down in UL and places like that, where there's groups of people coming together. And I think the barriers between kind of coaches and individuals and training groups are slowly kind of been broke, because I think there's a lot of new coaches, young coaches coming through that kind of just have that overall sort of open mindset to kind of ring another coach and ask, and you know, okay, do you know what we'll do? I'll get my athlete to jump in a session with your athlete. And I think that really helps. And then obviously, you know, from like my work with the Athletes Commission as well is really positive, because I think the Sport Ireland, I think the OFI, they're now beginning to listen to the athlete. You know, okay, you know, what do you want? How can we make things a little bit easier logistically? You know, what supports would you like? What would you like to see us do? And I think that's really, really positive. And I think when, you know, over the last couple of years been involved in that commission, there has been issues that athletes have brought to us, and we've addressed them. We've put them to the powers that be. And to be fair, the powers that be have listened. And I think if anything, that's really encouraging in terms of the kind of athlete centered and athlete focused. So I think overall, like, you know, we still have work to do. You know, we're still not at the forefront of high performance athletics in this country. But I think slowly there is an appetite there to change. And I think we've got some coaches coming through that are highly trained themselves. You know, they've gone away, they've gone to World Athletics, they've done all the high levels and stuff like that. And I think that's really good, because they're bringing that back in and they're helping the next generation of coaches. And I think that's really, really, it's really important, but it's also really positive.
And from being an elite athlete to now being set over in the background there, is there much that you see now that you didn't realize what the coaches and mentors and managers had to do to prepare you? And you just say, like, you know, maybe took it for granted while you're being the athlete, and now realize, geez, there's a whole lot more to it.
Oh, listen, yeah. Like, I think it's probably, you know, we're still in Ireland so reliant on volunteer coaches. Like, you know, when you look at, say, Athletics Ireland and their coaching setup, we still have very, very few paid full-time coaches. There's a couple in there that might be getting a few bob, but they're part-time. So you're kind of like, well, you know, they've got jobs, they've got families. And when I look at my own kind of experience with coaches, particularly here in Ireland, they were all volunteers. You know, my coach at when I won my first Europeans, GM Kidd, like he worked in the bank, you know, he had his own family. And I remember only the other day I was thinking about, God, do you remember he came away to Barcelona? We went on a training camp and I was like, and his wife came with him and the wife was off shopping in the hotel and he was down coaching with me. And that was probably like, you know, a romantic weekend away. That's probably what he sold to her, you know. And then she's like, well, geez, I didn't see him all weekend because he's coaching. And I think, you know, the point I'm making is that they give so much, you know, and I know, you know, from maybe getting involved in coaching, it's not just one day or one evening a week or at the weekend. Like Athletics is 11 months of the year. You know, you bring an athlete through all the phases, all the way to competition. And there's so many training sessions go in before you even get to compete. You know, I know in plenty of other sports that might be out every week and there's a game and there's probably something that kind of drives you to the next weekend. Whereas Athletics, it's such a long lead time. And that's probably something that I'm quite aware of now is like the amount of time that a lot of the coaches put in, unpaid time, you know, is phenomenal. And maybe that's why I haven't got into coaching just yet. But
very good.
And just one of the things you mentioned there about, I suppose, the openness of the coaches, like it's a very, like we've talked about it in a lot of the episodes here about the GA would be very intrinsic. Like we won't tell the lads down the road what we're doing, you know, because we've got the golden ticket. But you have seen that evolvement has happened in Athletics.
Yeah, no, it is there. Like obviously you're going to get certain individuals that will keep their cards close to the chest. But like I can remember back when I was coming through, I had a certain coach in a certain club, and you know there was another athlete who was in my club but trained with a different coach on the other side of Dublin City. And I can remember saying to my coach at the time, and it wasn't the coach I just mentioned, actually, it was someone different. But I said, oh, do you know what? I'm going to go out and do a session with so-and-so. And he lost the plot, literally lost the rag, and was like, why? No, you're not. No, you're not. You don't need to go over there. No, you're not. No, you're not. And like, I had no one else to train with. That was my logic was, well, but again, it can be a bit parochial. It can be a bit like, well, you might lose. And I think that sometimes is maybe the issue in Ireland is because we don't have a massive talent pool. You might get a gem coming through and then there could be the coach might be fearful that you might lose that athlete to someone else. And, you know, that could be the coach's ticket up the ranks as well and kind of the, you know, everything that comes with that. But from what I have gathered from chatting to a lot of the kind of, I'd say new coaches, the young coaches coming through, there's definitely more cohesion. There's more collaboration. There's more like, you know what, we'll actually look at our plans and see where we can maybe get a warm weather trip away with a few other groups, a few other people, a few other athletes, and build that all together. And that's like, I know for certain that's changed quite a lot, you know. So I think that is one of the biggest positives. And, you know, there still is people that are like, no, don't go near that person, or you're not training with them because they're same event, the same competition, you know.
Very good. And I know you mentioned going away with groups for the warm weather training. I don't know if you've seen it on Twitter. That's Kevin Cassidy is offering the GA teams to go up to Guido, one male team and one female team a weekend. I don't know what kind of incentive that is for teams, but anyway. Look, we better get going on the movie. Do you want to tell us what you picked and why you picked it?
Yeah, I picked Without Limits, which is based on the Steve Prefontaine story, basically. And Steve Prefontaine was an American icon back in the early 70s. He held every record from 2000 all the way up to 10K in America. And at the time, there was a couple of other athletes, but it created a huge running boom in America and really kind of brought, I suppose, middle to long distance on the track to the forefront of American athletics. And also what was quite unique with Prefontaine, he was young, he was a good looking fella, but tactically he always ran from the front. So he was aggressive and the fans loved it. And he just created a huge buzz around athletics. And, you know, he went on then the University of Oregon, connections with Nike and all these sort of things. And I think the big, like the, I suppose when you look at kind of his whole story, the fact that he was killed in a car crash at the age of 24, people would say he probably maybe never realized his own talent and where that might've got him. He did, as we'll talk about, finished fourth in the Helsinki Olympics, 74, and he was killed in 75. So I suppose when you look at his progression, he was only scratching the surface of what he could potentially do. And he still is an icon today in terms of athletics. Like over in the States, they have the Prefontaine Classic, which is a huge meet. He, this year in particular as well, Hayward Field, where he was literally unbeaten for his whole collegiate career. That is the venue of this year's World Championships in the University of Oregon. So, you know, Oregon, they call it's track town in America. It's the home of track and field. And it's, we haven't had a world champs in America for a long time. You know, I think the Olympics was probably the last big one back in 96. So, you know, it's a huge kind of year for athletics in America as well. Well, because of the market there, you know, but they would say kind of Prefontaine was probably one of the names, the icons to really kind of put athletics to the forefront, particularly middle distance and long distance in terms of American minds, you know.
Yeah, like I suppose one of the things early, and I suppose we'd see it within the GA, like, and I don't know what your own, and I know you've got a GA background as well, but the, when Hank from Breaking Bad came on the scene first, and it was like, how am I going to pick this guy out of the hundreds that are here, you know? And the natural talent shone through. But I suppose it's something that, like, it goes back to the Arsene Wenger's comment that we all think we have the best looking wife at home, you know, that I'd imagine coaches like that, and there's people probably talking to you, oh, this up and coming person, this up and coming person. And I suppose those people, to go from talented youth to Olympic level athlete, I suppose, is what you're looking for. Like, it's a fairly hard road to get there. Like,
oh yeah, like very much so. And I think, you know, in the story, it's quite, that's what I actually kind of liked it. And, you know, one of the reasons I picked this kind of film was I can remember watching it like years ago when I was only a young fella, you know, because of Prefontaine, and, you know, everyone would have known who he was and what he was about in terms of athletics. And that's one of the reason I kind of picked it tonight, because it creates that story and gives an insight into what it's like in America, you know. And you have kind of the scout and you have two other athletes going out to try and entice them to come to Oregon. And, you know, that stuff still goes on over in the States. Like, that's how they get the high schoolers to go to the universities. And, you know, that talent is huge over there. But you hear about it and you go, oh, this fella's ran this and this fella's good. And I think when in the movie, when the scout, another Bill, goes and watches the cross country race, and your man's just like, he's annihilated and everybody else is kind of like, well, hang on a second. This guy maybe has something. And also the fact that every other university were trying to kind of coax him to their place, you know, obviously shows that this guy is good. But, you know, it is kind of, I suppose you could say, the cream always rises to the top. You know what I mean? You have these guys breaking all sorts of records. And that's probably maybe slightly different to other sports, is there's always a measurement in athletics. There's always a time. There's always something that you can base off a current age group. And, you know, even like his junior, I think it was his junior record, I can't remember off the top of my head, the 5K, whatever it was only broken kind of recently enough in the last number of years by, I think, Galen Rupp, who some of you might know, who was very kind of medal at global championships recently. So that kind of shows you the level that he had. But I suppose it is that kind of question about, right, at a young age, breaking all the records, but what happens next? You know, how do you actually nurture that talent? What do you do? And I think the story goes really well into his own personality, which some coaches might just go, no, I'm not dealing with this. Can't do that. And I think that's the nice kind of side of the story towards the end, is that they met in the middle. They found that middle ground that they both knew how flexible each other were, and they were able to work through that. But a lot, like, for me, that's one of the key things I got out of that early relationship, was like, how is this going to work? Because they just were polar opposites, you know.
Prefontaine, he wasn't a fan of the word talent. He was more about, no, this is, I give everything. It wasn't like something that he was God-given talent. And is that something you come across, that the people who just rely on their talents don't go on as far as those who are, say, the workers are? Is there some sort of, there's a cross there as well?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely spot on. I think, like, God, when I look at my kind of journey, like, there's, I crossed paths with many athletes that were just ridiculously talented, like just so talented. But I always kind of think, and this is my own kind of perspective on it, is that, like, strength, speed, mindset, all that sort of stuff, yeah, it's a talent, but the talent to work hard, the talent to kind of really put everything in that you need to, and not rely that, like, oh, I'm naturally gifted. And I think what you find is when you get to a certain level, you realize that that work has to be put in. And those that aren't willing to do that won't have those long careers, or, you know, won't take a defeat well and just kind of almost pack it in. And there's been a few athletes, and even Irish athletes, that have been ridiculously talented and just didn't seem to want it as much as other people. And their career probably never got to where I think it probably should have done. And I think that's the kind of nice thing that, and that's probably why people were attracted to Pri. You know, that's why I think there was, like, the fans really jumped on it, because it was the minute it was gone to tape, you know what I mean? He led and he put everything in from the get-go. And I think you could kind of see it as well, that, like, when he first went to Oregon, there was probably, he was brash, he was arrogant, he was, you know, he believed in his own kind of talent and all the rest of it, but people didn't like that. And you could see a couple of the other kind of teammates kind of going, oh, I don't know if I'm into this fella. But by, as the story evolves, you can see the impact he had on other people. Next, he is the person, and maybe that's fame and all the rest of it, but, like, you can kind of see that people actually like them. And probably like the way he kind of approached it, and he, I suppose that work ethic would kind of rub off on people.
Yeah, no.
You talked about the, you say the coach athlete relationship there, and how, Jesus, how is it going to work? Like, and it was fascinating to watch, and I'll actually put this film up there in the top three or four that we've actually watched, because.
I'm taking the podium on that, not fourth. I'll take.
Okay, okay. So you're not taking the Prefontaine fourth in the Olympics, no?
No, no.
No, do you know what? Right, we say third, so top three. But it was because the relationship was so, and they portrayed it so authentically, you know? And, like, the film starts off with Bill talking, from the start I tried to change him, and from the start he wouldn't change. And then you get to the eulogy at the end, and he thought, so Bill is the coach, but it was Pri who was really the coach, because he taught Bill that he was wrong, you know, and that kind of way. And, like, he in theory he would have changed some of his methods. And, like, I felt, you know, when Pri came back to Oregon and asked, could he train with the team? Right? And Bill was given that speech that he'd given at the start of the film. Yeah. But as he was giving it, I was listening and goes, he no longer believes what he's saying there. Mm-hmm. You know, and then Pri was behind him, and people weren't paying attention. Pri was behind him. And then you could see that Bill understood nearly in that moment what it was really all about.
Yeah.
Now, and it was just so powerful, just the relationship and how they sparked off each other. And then we'll say a couple of weeks after he rejoins Oregon or whatever, just from the trainer perspective, and he goes in and he asks Bill, does he agree with his wife?
Yeah.
Everything. Right. Sorry, do you believe everything? Believe everything your wife does? And he says, no, but I believe in her.
Mm.
You know? And immediately Pri is gone, because he got the information in that one sentence that he needed to deal with the struggles he had with his own life at that, in his own relationships at that stage.
Yeah.
And that sort of a going from how good a coach technically is to that sort of a scenario shows massive growth in the coach through dealing with the, as Liam Morgan would call it, the boil.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And, like, you mentioned someone great there, Liam Morgan, but, it, like, all of that, like towards the end, when that kind of happened, you could see the passion that Bill, the coach, got from having that talented athlete back in, and like what it did for him and probably, you know, everyone else around him. But like even just around that moment as well, when he came back and dealing with that big defeat, what I really liked was Bill was like, you know what, I'm just going to get you to run, you know, and he was off like Pre was off running everywhere, you know what I mean, just doing his own mileage and stuff like that. And what I thought was really good about that was like he's now coaching the individual, not the event. And I think that's really important, you know, when you're coaching, particularly an individual, because you got to learn the athlete. You got to, what makes them tick? Who are they? You know, and I've seen that, like, even in my own training group when I was training, I trained with a fellow called Martin Rooney, who, you know, phenomenal athlete. He's won Europeans. He broke Roger Black's junior British record when he, like, at the age of 19, he was, like, sixth in Beijing. This kid, like, he was amazing. But we were different. And my coach, when I was over in England, Nick would come to me and put the arm around me and, oh, Dave, that was a great session. But he didn't need to do that to, say, Rooney. You know, Rooney probably needed a different approach. And I think what's really good and what really kind of came across to me is that journey from the start when, like, it's all about the coach. No, you're doing what I'm telling you to do. And then at the end, it's like, well, I know this guy. I know what makes him tick and I know what will make him work. And I think, you know, coming off that defeat, there had to be a bit of love given. There had to be, right, I understand how I'm going to get him back in love with the sport. And I thought that came across really, really well.
Yeah, and you talk about that there, like coaching the individual or the athlete rather than coaching the event. And again, from the eulogy, I thought Bill summed it up really well. Like he would have looked at things as arbitrary, either win or you come second, you're third, you lose or whatever. He says a mediocre effort could win and a magnificent effort could lose, you know, and learning that if you yourself is the barometer of performance rather than the opposition, then you're really kind of excelling or looking to get the most out of yourself.
It's a bit like that
clip that was shared online there for the last few weeks about the coach in Scotland with that young girl.
Yeah, Frank Dick, yeah.
And 100 metres and her you know, goal that, like, was beating herself.
I'm amazed that I saw that a while ago. I think that's a couple of years old.
Yeah, it looks like, yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. I remember seeing it and then, I don't know who posted it, but it got so much leverage. But like, it's everything, you know, like when dealing with young kind of athletes and coaching them and things like that. And like, it's something that I've kind of would be probably high up in my philosophy is to get to know the athlete, the individual. And then the event comes after that. And I think, you know, like when the whole kind of pre-story, you have this kind of arrogant young lad who thinks he's going to just going to take over the world, you know? And I think that's a nice kind of part of it is that he gets to a certain level, he improves, he goes to the NCAAs, he wins all that, he's breaking the records. But then he goes to the next level and like the lads kind of, you know, he's up against lads in Helsinki who, you know, you're talking about like Lassie Vernon, who went on to hold the world record. Like that fella in his own right is an icon in terms of distance running. But like they kind of schooled him in many ways. And even that race and like the facts are all spot on. Like he did negative splits, like his last... Mm. His last mile was faster than the previous two in that 5K, you know, and it was like he couldn't give anything more in that last mile, but it just wasn't there. And the fourth place and all the rest of it. So like, yeah, like I think the story's well told, and you know, I think that relationship is something that I think anyone who's coaching can kind of, you know, understand it, you know, particularly whether you're dealing with a team or an individual, there's always a couple of people that maybe you have to have those honest and tough conversations and you bounce off each other, you know.
There was like my favorite line from the film, went back to the eulogy again, and he's once talking to Pre and he goes, I'll never understand you, Pre. And Pre came back with the comment, says, who says you have to? Yeah. And I thought that was just sums like what a coach should be. Like, everybody is different, and you don't have to understand why they're doing this or how they're doing this. That's just the way people are sometimes. And you just have to adapt to them as a coach. And I thought that was just summed up the film brilliantly. But,
yeah, and you make a good point there, because, like, again, like, I always remember someone telling me, like, you know, let the coaches take the reins. You just do what you do. You don't need to know everything. Because I think nowadays, like, a lot of sports people, we overanalyze everything. You know, and there's, like, we've got so much technology, and, you know, even recreational runners are on Strava, and you're looking at segments and who did this and who did that. But, you know, all these kind of stat sports and stuff like that. And there's actually, there's a book about cyber psychology in sports. So when, like, sports people now are kind of really overanalyzing that and the impact that has, and you can see what your competitors are doing. So I need to be doing this. And it's just, it's an interesting thing, that line, because, like, sometimes you don't need to know everything. You just need to get out and do what you do.
Very good. I'm getting the feeling that Massey and Paul only watched the last 10 minutes of the movie. all the references have been the eulogy. Just go back on one thing that happened earlier in the movie. I know it's Bill and Bill were the two boys, but Hank, as we know him from Breaking Bad, I think it was the first race he ran for the college, and he didn't do what the plan was. And Bill Bowerman was kind of giving out about it, and the other Bill says, we could always try telling him to stop, you know. And I suppose, just from a coaching perspective, to have someone to challenge you on your thing can be very very good for a coach, that it's not just my way and the highway. Like, there's actually somebody, just, it might just be that something every now and again, but just a small challenge on the person. I thought that's a nice thing to have for a coach, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Like, that was the first race he ran with Oregon, and he was told to kind of, you know, not front run. Like, you know, he was against a decent athlete, and it was like, okay, like, let's see how the race unfolds, hang back a little bit. But sure, he didn't do any of that. He went from, you know, as he normally would. And it's a good moment, because I think Bowerman, the head coach, literally turns his back. He actually turned his back on the race. And then Hank or Bill kind of was like, you know, it's impressive. And I suppose, like, you know, in a coaching relationship, it's good to have that. And again, I know a couple of coaches that would kind of, they'd bounce things off other people. And I think that's really, really healthy. And I always look at, say, like, even GAA soccer, Premier League, you know, that relationship between, like, the head coach and the assistant coach, you know, and you can look at the likes of, say, Man United is a good example of, like, the great names that they've had come in over the last while. And then you have the likes of Carrick in there, or even the Giggs. And you always kind of wonder, what's the relationship there? Are they strong enough to stand up to the head coach and say, do you know what, like, that's not right, or do it a different way? And I can only imagine, like, you know, having someone like that in the short term, yeah, it's probably a pain in the arse at times. But I'd say the long term, it's like, well, you're both kind of developing, you're both grown, you're trying to kind of solve problems. And it's nice to have someone there that can do that with you. And I think that kind of came across well in the movie, because as it goes on, you can see kind of other coaches that are involved kind of saying, well, like, you know, he's going to run an American record, or he's going to, you know, and you can see slowly Bowerman beginning to turn here and actually going, well, you know what? Yeah, go out in front, run, you know, that's what you do. Go do it.
Like, the thing as well for that scene with me, and again, it shows Bowerman's improvement during the film. So, like, he goes out and he says, run 69 for the first laps. And he goes out and he runs 64 and he runs 64. And he sets a new record at that time. Like, he didn't set an appropriate challenge for Pre at that stage. So Pre wasn't interested, and he was trying to show off. But then later on in the film, when he says, look, you know what, you can run 13:23, and Pre's going, well, that's fucking 7 seconds quicker than the current one. Now you're actually challenging me. And he took on board his message then, because it's like, I actually need a bit of help here to make that level, you know. And I thought, again, that showed really good coaching and learning how to deal differently with that unique talent.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's a really good point, because I think one of his first training sessions when he went to Oregon, he was out with the group, and he's looking around going, like, this is too slow for me. you know, he's almost looking, and the coach is kind of going, what's it? You're not running in the pack. And I think you're absolutely right. It's that kind of journey of actually, right, well, this guy needs to be challenged maybe a little bit differently to the group of athletes that are training with him. You could see then when he's given that challenge that he suddenly has vigor, he's got enthusiasm, he's just like, I want this now. And unfortunately, that's at the end of it, you know, because that's when, you know, things obviously don't go the way he would like. He gets killed, you know. But you can, I think they painted that very well in terms of, right, you know, how you manage someone with those talents, that you have to maybe treat them a little bit differently. You have to kind of give them the challenge. They thrive on constantly having a challenge and something that maybe is out of their comfort zone. And that's what really kind of pushes them and pulls them on through to the next level.
As a coach, you know, like, let's open to all of you, like, that what you're talking about there for an individual sport is really, I won't say it's easy, but it's easier than working with a team sport, you know, because I'm sure we can all think of players that were challenging for some reason, or like a classic thing in the GA, like if you don't turn up training, you're not playing the matches, you know. But like that, some of these exceptionally talented players, the training session just might not get them going, you know.
Yeah.
So like how could you, or can you think of anything that could work with those type of people in a team setting? Because like a lot of the time the teams is we're all treated the same, we get the same fair and equal treatment, you know. We can't be given special treatment to Massey just because he's brilliant, like.
You're right, like it is difficult because you're dealing with bigger numbers. I suppose what I would say there, it comes down to time. And one of the things that I'd kind of look at is, like, you know, when we talk about what is high performance, I think high performance is actually time. You know, if you have the time to give an individual or a team, well, I think they can improve. Okay. But in a team scenario, you'll have to give time to each individual, and you might have to actually kind of sit down and go, right, okay, what are the weak points? What are the areas for development? What are your strengths? And that takes an awful lot of time. So again, from a team perspective, and one thing that it was in the movie was his, I can't remember the word he used, but it was like the performance meetings or something like that, where he was meeting the player or meeting the athletes individually. And I can't remember what exactly he said, but he said to like the other Bill, oh, put him last, you know, on our performance meetings, obviously because he was going to give him more time, or he didn't want someone coming in. And I think in a team environment, if the scenario was available where you could actually go through a performance meeting with each individual and actually pinpoint areas that they wanted to work on, well, then maybe. So again, it could be like your kicking, it could be your general fitness, it could be conditioning, it could be food, it could be rest. Like, there's so many different things, and it's very hard to do that when you're dealing with a squad of 25 to 30, you know. But that's probably where maybe that little kind of nugget here, or a little kind of chat on the side of the pitch going like, how are you getting on? Right, I've noticed this. I need you to be a little bit more like this, this or that. And maybe that's a way of doing it. But again, it comes back to time. And that's where I think, you know, we talk an awful lot about high performance in this country. Like, what is high performance? And, you know, I listen to like, you know, I know Shane McCormick well, who's with Phil Healy. I know a couple of other athletes and who are coached by people abroad. And, you know, the difference would be abroad is that some of these people are full-time and they're able to do that. Whereas like in Ireland, a lot of our top coaches, they're volunteers. And I think that's one of the fundamental differences. And I think when you look at the movie, like Bill Bowerman, University of Oregon, he's a full-time paid coach. He has the resources. He has the time to do that. And like when those athletes go to Helsinki, if there was an Irish person in that race, you'd be guaranteed that Irish fella was probably working, you know, 5 days in a week, you know, whereas the others are training full time. And that's a huge difference. And I think when it comes down to those little nuggets and that time that you get with that individual, I think the more performance setups of full time people and full time resources, that's where they get it.
You can really see that when the Irish boxing joined the high performance unit, and the results from that were like staggering, like pretty quickly, and not quickly, but you know, in the next 5 to 10 years. And it just shows you what can happen when money can be spent, and as more importantly, what time can be spent with individual athletes.
Yeah, hugely. Like, and that's actually a really good example, because like the journey of, like, I can remember competing in Beijing and the likes of Gary Keegan and stuff were all there. And it's when they really kind of came to the fore in terms of winning medals. And like, I remember after that, I was fascinated with that. And I was like onto Gary, and I was onto like the likes of Jerry Hussey. And I wanted to know what they were doing, because I can remember being in the Olympic Village and the boxers came in, like Egan and all the lads, and they were so... They were just so at ease. It was amazing at this Olympic Games, and like some of us were just riddled with tension, and the boxers were just like, they were sparring in like outdoors in the village. They were just so chilled out. And I remember then, like, I think it was Jerry was like, come on out to the national arena, and I went out to the national arena, and like, you'd barely go to the jacks in the place. It was that bad. And yeah. But this was their home and they loved it. Yeah. And you're kind of going, you don't need flashy, all like freshly painted stuff. This was their high performance. But you hit the nail on the head. They had time. And I think what they actually used to do was like, they bring all the athletes up to Dublin. They have like an intensive kind of couple of days, weekend, maybe 2 weeks even. And then they'd all go home. They'd all come back. And it was a great model. And it obviously kind of worked. And now they're out in Abbottstown and they've... phenomenal setup, and should I keep getting results, you know?
I was just going to say there, we do some of our development squad work in a pitch in Cork City, and Jesus, up on the top of the hill, and during the winter, when we do a lot of the development squad stuff, it would be absolutely Baltic up there, you know, and the brother Sean is involved as well, and he'd say that this is where all Ireland's are won, because, you know, like that now, it's just that kind of setting that, oh, you dread going there, just because you know it's going to be windy, and if it's raining, and you know, there's no shelter or nothing like that, you know, and it just if they can come through a bit of hardship, you're talking about with the National Arena, like that, you know, when they do get the luxury, then they're able to just perform at the level required.
But actually, like, it was funny enough, like, and I've heard stories where a lot of them didn't like Abbottstown; they thought it was too nice, you know, and they liked that element, you know. Yeah. And to be fair, like, I love that. Like, I love doing the winter stuff. I loved getting out. We used to do a lot of kind of fartleks and stuff like that during, you know, November, December, January. The weather's brutal. But I loved it. Like, that was kind of my bread and butter. And I always would kind of say to myself, you know, this is where the medals are won, Davies. You know, this is the shit you have to do. And I used to think of, like, you know, the Americans and Jamaicans. They go, they're not fucking doing this, Gillick. You know, you're this. Like, and you're just kind of, you know, again, you're just looking for any little kind of, yeah, kind of kicker, you know, that was one.
Some Rocky Four vibes going on there. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a book, actually, The Goldmine Effect by Rasmus Ankerson. And he went out to Jamaica to have a look at what their setup was like. Right. So we arrived at this place, like, and it's, again, really humble surroundings, not in any way high performance, but it's high performance people that are there and really driven on, like, you know. Yeah. And that humility that comes from, yeah, like, there's no magic formula to success. Like, having some, you'll say, flashy neon colours isn't going to make you win anything. It's the Prefontaine work hard and be, you have your talent being able to endure pain or whatever it is, like.
Yeah, yeah, like, and I do kind of sometimes think about, like, you know, what the athletes have now and the resources that are available. And there's always that, like, you know, are we wrapping them in cotton wool too much? Are we giving them everything? Like, do they need to go through a bit of graft and kind of figure it out themselves? And I think, you know, sometimes when I look at, say, the athletes who I was kind of competing with, the Irish athletes, Dermot O'Rourke, Paul Hessian, people like that, Rob, you know, they all had to endure a bit of, like, okay, what am I going to do next? You know, where do I need to go? Do I need to leave? Do I need to get a new coach? And I think sometimes that's very much kind of character building as well. You've got to go through that kind of, you know, pain almost to try and figure things out. And I think that it does stand to you. I think it kind of gives you a bit more kind of oomph about what you're doing and what you're trying to do. And also you've invested in it. You know, you've made some hard choices. You've invested through it. So when the chips are down, you kind of realize, well, like, I've put everything into this. And I think that's really important. And, you know, that I actually haven't read that book, but I did read The Bold Supremacy is another one where a lad went over and kind of, you know, really looked in deep into the whole of Jamaica. Why were they getting medals and all the rest of it? And yeah, like, and I trained over in the States as well. And like, at the time, it was like Tyson Gay and some of the fastest guys on the planet. And all it was a track. Like, that was it. Granted, yes, it was in Florida and they had decent weather, but it was just a bog standard track. No glamour about it, you know, but full-time coaches, paid coaches, you know, it goes back to that kind of time element.
And just going then to your own, say, when you finished your athletic career and you went back to GA, maybe at the start just for a bit of fun or whatever it is, and then you went to a pretty decent standard then senior football with Ballantyre. Did you get frustrated, say, going as a start, nearly a professional athlete, going to dealing with other athletes who are in the dressing room who mightn't give the team the same commitment as you were used to? Did you find that frustrating?
Yeah, there was little things, you know. I think, you know, I went back and I didn't really expect a whole lot, you know. I'll be honest with you, where I got frustrated was probably not directly with my team or the management. Like, there was some good lads in there, the club, and it's a club I grew up in, you know, my brothers and my dad, we're all heavily involved. And, you know, I didn't expect to go in and be kind of like treated any differently. I didn't expect to be like, you know, having dinners and all the rest of it after training. But what did frustrate me was when it came to the summer and it just stopped.
Yeah.
I could not get my head around that. I was like, what are we doing? We were playing senior two. So senior championship in Dublin, we were senior two. And we were good outfit. Like, we were trying to get up to senior one. And then, like, it would get to, you know, you'd have maybe your 25 lads at training. And then the season would literally stop. Like, Dublin were doing well. So everything stopped. And we had nine lads at training. And it was like on a Saturday morning. And I was just going, what the fuck is this? You know, you've spent, and you talk about, like, you know, the muck and the shit. Like, you do that in January for the summer, and then it gets to the summer and there's no games. And it's just like my mind boggled. And to be honest with you, I did that for 1 year and I went back the following year and then it happened again. And I was just like, I've got kids. Like, you know, I'm coming up here on a Saturday morning. She's going like, well, what are you doing? I've got training and then there's no games. And like, my wife's from England, like, so the GA is alien to her. And she's like, so what are you training for? I'm like, to be honest, like, that's the biggest thing that frustrated me. And it was just a little bit like, you know, the lads were training, the lads were doing it all, and then there was no games and people lose interest, you know. So, but I know what you mean. Was it a big change? It was. The dressing room was different, you know, because... You have a dressing room and there's other lads there, and you know, but I enjoyed it. I liked that element. It was different. I think I got to a stage where I'd finished my career and I struggled with that, and I was a little bit like always feeling isolated and always feeling alone, and it was all about me and what I was going to do. So it was nice to get involved with other things where it wasn't all about David. You know, there was other players and very good players, and, you know, I didn't have to make decisions. The manager made decisions, and I liked that. You know, it was kind of refreshing in many ways.
I know I have a friend of mine, and she was participated in two Olympics, and she said only after her career finished that she realized how selfish of an individual she was and had to be to get to where she was. And she just didn't realize what it was like going back into, say, non-athlete mode.
Yeah. And I think a lot of athletes kind of struggle with that, particularly coming from individual sports that, you know, and look, there's probably times that I do put myself as P1, you know, and then you kind of have to peg yourself back a bit. And, you know, but you like that's part of it. Like that's probably why I did what I did, because I was very much right. This is about me and everything else about me. And look at relationships and, you know, nights out and all those sort of things, you know, you kind of make your choices about. But there is that huge transition, like, you know, and it's funny, actually, you kind of, because even in the movie there, like there's a bit of a snapshot. It doesn't go into it too much, but he comes back from Helsinki and then it's like he's working in the bar, you know, and it's like, you know, and you can see that that's not him. You can see he's just a bit like, what am I doing? But he has, like, there is that moment where you kind of go, well, actually, what does happen after an Olympic Games? Like, you know, you go back to the real world and you just have to be a normal person.
There's a new book. There's a book out about that with Irish athletes. I haven't read it now. What happens when the lights go off or something like that?
Yeah. I know the book. Yeah. can't remember who wrote it there, but I know what you're talking about.
Damien.
Is it Damien Lawler?
Damien Lawler done it, yeah.
That's right, yeah, yeah. It's a really interesting space, because nobody's ever really, like, you hear the stories, and, you know, I know, like, I spoke about my kind of journey, but I learned an awful lot from hearing other people. Like, I heard Richie Sadler talk about his journey, and I remember going, like, fuck, like, Jesus. Sorry, I shouldn't curse.
You're okay. You're okay.
But I remember kind of going, like, yes, yeah, I can relate to that. I can relate to that, you know. And I think it's an important message. I think there's some people have the exit plan sorted. Some people know exactly what they're going to do. But you've also got to remember, like, even when we're talking about coaches, there's a lot of athletes that would have been so ingrained with their various coaches for so many years, and probably would have spoken to them every single day. And then it's over. Like, then it's done. It's gone. And again, maybe you can reference that in the movie when Pree does come back and he's standing behind Bowerman and he's like, you know, we touched on it earlier on, is like, oh, can I come back? But for a lot of athletes, they don't get that choice. And everything that kind of comes with that can be very difficult. So I think, yeah, that book's probably a decent read, you know, because if people are open and honest, it would be fascinating for the next generation to kind of, you know, learn about that time, you know, because it will come.
Yeah, what you mentioned there about the relationship between the athlete, let's say, and the coach, just as you were saying it, I was thinking Jimmy McIlroy and Blades of Glory with the coach, just together for 20 years and then bang, just cut off, you know, just relationships and stuff like that. That, like, I suppose for a coach, you know, coaches may probably have the next athlete to take them under the wing and to keep them kind of occupied mind. But for an athlete who mightn't have that sort of support system that was always there, to see it sort of vanquished must be hard for people.
Oh no, yeah, absolutely. And, like, you know, I've seen it with other athletes. Like, it's everything revolves around their athletics, their sport, you know, and everything comes from that. And whether it's confidence, self-belief, self-worth, you know, it all comes from a training session, a performance, you know, going to an Olympic Games. And that could take 4 years, it could take 8 years, you know, and then suddenly it's all over. And, you know, I suppose a coach is doing his job. He's got to look at the pipeline, the next athletes coming through, and particularly, you know, in the NCAA setup, it's all results. And, you know, it's very cutthroat, as is a lot of sport. You know, it's about bringing through, and you can't have dead wood. You can't just have someone just taking up your time if they're not going to produce the goods. And unfortunately, that's kind of high performance sport. And like you said, like, relationships, it's, it's even in my own experience, like, just people who I would have spent an awful lot of time with, I probably don't really speak to them anymore, you know, like, for various reasons. But I suppose it's a time in your life and you move on.
Yeah. Was there anything else from the movie that stood out for you, David?
His time away from track as well, like, you know, there's a love story thrown in there as well. But, like, because I was watching it with my own wife and we were kind of laughing, going, like, Jesus, like, you know, it's balancing all of that, you know, and it's the relationships, and there's someone else who doesn't run, you know. So Mary is the girl, his girlfriend, and, like, she doesn't run. So, like, you know, her life is completely different to what his life is, and he's preparing to go. I think they reference Finland and stuff like that, and he goes away to Finland. He's like, oh, will you be here for me when I come back and stuff like that? Because, you know, he can't go out. He can't have that lifestyle that maybe a lot of collegiates or young people may have, and he's trying to have a relationship with someone that can have that kind of lifestyle. And I think for a lot of young sports people and sports people in general, there is that kind of relationship management that has to take place, you know, and that understanding. So your reference about, like, the priority, like, you know, like, you put yourself first, but then there's someone there that maybe has to kind of understand that, and how do you go negotiate that? And I just thought it was an interesting, because where he's at this phase of his life, you know, he's 19, 20, 21, he's in college, just so many distractions. And I think you kind of get a little snapshot of that when he's there with the shoes and all the girls are going around to various shoes. The popularity and all the rest of it that came with him, and how do you manage that? How do you control it? And I think it's, like, it's another kind of because you lose talent to that. Let's be honest, you do. You know, that sort of lifestyle, all the rest of it. Suddenly, people aren't as committed to their training. They're committed to other stuff. You know.
Mary explained it well there. When he asked him, when she said to him, "You're still in the shoe business."
Yeah.
Which is a good way. And you know what, as lads know, I like Adidas runners. There was two things in it for me that were really, really good and massive learning points. So when he got the foot injury from his adventurous social life, right? And he needed a couple of stitches there in his toes, right? And I suppose player welfare and people being injured and being asked to compete when they're injured, I suppose, is always a big talking point. And it was really interesting Priya's view on it, right? When Bill says, "No, you can't compete, you're injured. It will do serious damage to your foot." And he was like, "Yeah, but what psychological damage will it do to me if I can't?" You know, so that actually was something that was really thought-provoking for me, in that we'd say if people are half injured, the psychological effect of not picking them is when they're so wrapped up in their athletic identity is a massive thing. And then the other thing that really stuck out for me is we say in them early stages when he got to Oregon, the quality of the technical coaching by Bill Bowerman, I thought, was top class. And his use of analogies, you know, like, and the one he said, like about getting the hips right, it's like at the moment of deepest penetration, you know, and that registered with Pri straight away that he knew what he meant. You know,
registered with you as well, Paul.
All of us did it.
But you know, it was that type of a description that would get people to understand what it is that's actually needed. And then, like, the real quality of the coach, you know, when he grabs him by the neck and he holds him, going, "Jesus, what's going on here?" And then he says 190 beats a minute, you know. And he talks, he's just serious, fair and detailed in how he went about it. Even though it's unorthodox, we'll say, it was potentially the exact right thing that was needed for Pri and other people at that stage of their life and at that stage of their development.
Yeah. This is actually really good points there as well. Yeah, it's again, it's that kind of coach athlete. Maybe he did understand what he could say to him and know that, right, this lad's going to get this. And again, it kind of simplifies it very much. Because you could see it in the movie as well. When he said it straight away, he knew exactly, and he changed his body positions and stuff like that. Probably body positions isn't the way to kind of to paint that, but no, it wasn't that descriptive. But no, it is, and there was always that constant kind of battle. You kind of felt as well that, like, you know, are they going to get along? Is it going to work out? And I think that was probably the nice kind of way as the movie kind of progressed, that there is that kind of they actually did begin to understand each other, which was really, really nice. And again, you know, that kind of player welfare, I can talk all day about my own kind of injuries and having to go down training, even though one thing that always fascinates me is I've kind of worked with a couple of GA teams, and, like, you know, you'd have the lads who'd be injured would still come down and show up. And I always kind of think, I couldn't do that. I literally could not do that. Because in my experience, when I couldn't run or I couldn't train and I went down training, and I remember we used to have, like, an exercise bike overlooking the track over in Loughborough where I was. And I do a bike session whilst looking at the people I was training with or even competing against training. And it just, like, I was focusing on them. I was like, I can't do that. They're getting ahead of me. And I wasn't focusing on what I could do. And that, like, you know, mentally would just eat away at me. So, like, I had a long-term injury and I was just like, right, I'm not going down to the track. I'm not going. And like, yeah, I have to take myself out of that. But I think it's that kind of impact that has on the mental, because I think that then is directly linked to the physical. And if you don't feel good or feel good about yourself, well, then it just impacts more on the physical. And you just think you kind of wallow in self-pity. But I like when that actually happened in the movie, I was like, oh, he's not going to let him run. No way. He's not going to run. But he did, and he done well. But yeah, I think that there was a crazy element to him as well, I think, you know. And I think as other athletes in that race were like, man, you're bonkers. What are you doing? I think you can kind of come across that, like, there was that element to Pre that, you know, sometimes he was a bit away with things, you know, and probably didn't really kind of, he tended to live in the now. I felt a lot of it. He wasn't really looking at kind of long term or anything like that. It was like, boom, I'm just going to do this now and get through it.
Very good. There was one thing I really loved from Bowerman when he got them all to meet at 7:27, and they all arrived and they're wondering, why did you not just say 7:30? And he just says, well, if I said 7:30, or 7:27, you think something big is going to happen. And I just thought it was brilliant, just that keeping that curiosity of keeping the players on their toes, or the team on their toes, is brilliant. But there's one thing there, and I don't think we'll get into it now, it's for another show, is about his visualization of his splits. And like even the last scene, the tragic scene there, like he was just thinking about, I'm going to run it this time, then I'm going to go, this I'm going to go. But that's something that was brilliant. And I'm sure we'll have another show lined up about something like that again, Colm, I think.
Possibly, Bossy. We'll see how we get on. That's brilliant. Look, David, thanks very much for your time.
One last thing there, David. I'm always curious. I'm watching the Olympics, the athletics, something like that, and all the events claim to be the toughest event or the toughest event. It's either the 200 meters or the 400 meters, and 400 hurdles, the claim, then the decathlons or the mile or whatever it is. What's the toughest event for an athlete?
Yeah, I would say, yeah, anything from like 4 to 8. But even in the science of it all, you're hitting both systems, you know. So it's that like pure lactic, like where you got to be like, as to describe an element of my training, like a lot of our training, you have to hit those systems. So you know, when I look at distance runners, there's an element of recovery runs in there as well, and they're going at easy pace, whereas we never really had that. Everything did is quite hard. And then I look at like, you know, a long jump and I go, oh God, it wouldn't be great to just jump into a sand, like, you know. Fours to eights, I think, tend to be the ones that kind of hit the hardest. You know?
Very good.
You should try it some days. Maybe there's a podcast. I'll go down and run 400 for it.
We might run the 400 between us.
Yeah, maybe 3 defibrillators on site. Well, here, the last thing I meant to say, how was the actor, you meant Billy Crudup, how was his form as a runner?
We actually, like, my wife used to run as well. That's how we met. And we were watching it going, like, the way they made the movie was actually very realistic in terms of the people they got to run. Like, I remember watching a movie before where Tom Cruise was in, and actually Tom Cruise produced this, which was, I didn't actually know that until it popped up, but I can't remember the movie Tom Cruise in, and they had a running coach for Tom Cruise to like perfect his technique to make it more realistic. And in the movie, like that we watched, Steve Prefontaine, all the athletes, you'd almost think they were all runners. You know, I thought that came across really, really well, because there is some movies out there where like you're going, there's not a chance these people are athletes. And I can't remember the name of the fellow who played Pre, like, he looked like an athlete. Like he was in pretty good mix, you know.
Yeah. Right?
It was Jason McAteer played him, was it?
It was one time, I think it was a picture. I don't know, was he crossing the line maybe when he came back, maybe his last race, but it just his heel was right up at his arse, you know, and it didn't show the bottom half, but his heel was gone that far up as he was kind of sprinting, like, and I just got, you know, I know I'm just going from very, very basic knowledge that, you know, the further your legs go up and move, you know, the better, rather than the fellas with the shorter, lower steps, you know. So I just thought, no, just when I seen that, I just said, he was obviously not a bad athlete himself.
No, he wasn't. But also, like, Pre did have a bit of an odd style of running as well. And I suppose most recently you might look at like Michael Johnson, who had that very upright chest out where, and like people would always say, you know, first thing a coach would have done is change the way Michael Johnson ran, but he could have been completely making a mess of him. So they didn't. And Johnson went on to be who he was. And Pree was kind of in that category where you would look at them and go, this lad looks like his biomechanics are all over the place. But it worked for him. But I know the shot you're looking at, it was that kind of head-on shot where the two of them are really kind of going for it. And I'd probably make it a movie. I can only imagine many times they had to do that. So maybe there was like fatigue coming in naturally. But I thought overall, like the people that they use, and I think they might have used some real footage at certain times as well.
Yeah,
I think they did that, yeah. And I thought that was kind of good because it gave you a real kind of sense. And even the commentary, I think particularly for the Olympic commentary, it was some of the real footage. Yeah. And it kind of just made it more realistic, which I think was really good when it comes to a sporting movie.
Yeah, it was a brilliant film. It was a really good film. Really good film.
Yeah, like there's another one. I think it's called Pre, actually. But this one was, this is more recent, like 97, 98. And I think there was more money put into it, so it came across better. But like, you know, for any athlete coming up through the ranks and stuff like that, like people will always talk about Prefontaine because that kind of iconic figure. But the movie would be always one that athletes would watch, you know, before a race or before an athletic meet, you know, and kind of get themselves pumped.
Very good. I think in concluding, I think if you're ever going to get a job as a coach, the ideal job would be coaching movie stars how to run properly. I think that sounds like a nice gig over in Hollywood for you, David, if you ever get over there. Look, thanks very much again for your time, David.
Thank you, David.
Just throw out your Twitter handle there so people can find you or whatever. So
David Gillick on Twitter and Instagram. Yeah, so that's where I am.
Excellent. Thanks very much, and best luck now if you get back in the GA pitch again. That maybe the lads might get a change in the seasons might suit a little bit better.
Well, funnily enough, I haven't kicked the ball in a while. I won the pandemic and all that, but this is the thing about the GAA. I know we're cutting time here, but I did go back after my playing senior because my brother was captain of like the third team up in John. So I went up and did that, and then we were training against the second team, and I tore my pec. Stupidly arm in, tore my pec, and then I had to get surgery on that a year ago. So, so the lads were calling me one tit for ages. Literally, I had nothing. So I don't know now. If I was to tell herself I'm going back to play football, she'd be like, "Hang on here, Seth." But, no, look, I'll keep myself fit. I'm still back running there, doing park runs, and I cycle a good bit now. And I just try and kind of look after myself.
Well, I've never torn any muscles like that, but I never built up any of those muscles to tear. So I think that's the difference. Do less and you won't get hurt. But look, that's super. Thanks very much for your time, David.
No worries, lads. Thanks a million.
Thanks,
cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We are into season 5 now, so thanks to everyone who has listened so far. We would be grateful if you would take the time to give us a retweet on Twitter or just share it with your friends. It would also be great if you give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean a lot to us and we really appreciate it. Hope you all had a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. See you next week, everybody.